My name is Brooke, and I'm an alcoholic. Please be advised that the bathroom we normally use are no longer available. Please use the bathrooms accessible through the door to my left and follow the signs. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons are Kareth and Giroux. They have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Charles will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Charles, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Michelle will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Michelle. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Michelle. The 12 steps. Number one, we admitted we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we are wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Katie will read the traditions.
Thank you. I'm Katie, I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for a group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, or prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need to always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of tonight's meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, the first of which will speak on the eighth tradition, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker to share on the eighth tradition is Scott M.
Hi, everyone. I'm Scott. I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor's name is Bob S. My sobriety date is June 21, 07. And I was asked to speak on the eighth tradition, so just really quickly, I'm going to read the short form and then the long form. The one's called the long form, but they're both very short and very concise. The short form follows: Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. The long form: Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. We define professionalism as the occupation of counseling alcoholics for fees or hire, but we may employ alcoholics where they are going to perform those services for which we might otherwise have to engage non-alcoholics. Such special services may well be recompensed, but our usual AA 12-step work is never to be paid for. I actually had a really beautiful experience looking at this eighth tradition, sort of digging into the history of it, and even just reading it and then reading it again. I was intimidated when I was asked to speak on it, but as I looked at it more and became intimidated less, because it is really so simple. It's nothing to be afraid to talk about. It's so simple. It's almost shocking how concise it is. That short form, the first one that I read, is just that one sentence, the A and the B. Forever non-professional, but we may employ special service workers. The second one is still that sentence, A and B, with some elaborations. The definition of that word non-professional, which is so crucial, because it would be so easy, at least for me, to misinterpret non-professional. And then elaboration on the service workers and a reiteration of the most important part right at the end. So the eighth tradition, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. We define non-professional. Well, it doesn't mean lazy or irresponsible or slovenly. And I could interpret it that way. I don't know about you. It means that we don't ever pay for 12-step work under any circumstance ever. And then it gets to this other part of the special service workers, and it elaborates on that full time, and it gets right back to, by the way, we don't ever pay for 12-step work, ever. And that's it. That's the eighth tradition. It's so simple, and I get to read it, and I get to be reminded that not only is this simple, although it didn't come from a simple problem, it is an elegant solution. AA itself is the same thing. It didn't come from a simple problem, but it's an elegant solution, and I have to be reminded of that. Not just because I make things more complicated in my head than they need to be, but because AA is huge. It's enormous. I went to the convention in San Antonio and got a taste of just how big and how elaborate AA can be. And I stand in a stadium full of people holding hands saying the Serenity Prayer, and all of this possible speakers speaking on every possible topic, and the flags and the fellowship, and rows of tents hawking AA wares, which I felt conflicted about, but I have to remind myself within all of that, and it is beautiful and it is elaborate, the AA is just one alcoholic working with another. It's just that simple, and doing it for free. And that's what this tradition reminds me of. I feel like, although it might seem obvious, I think it's important to say that traditions didn't come just one day into being, that they grew, that they came from experience. Something would rise up which would threaten the unity of the whole of our group, and then concepts would be discussed and principles. And this topic of money in AA has always been a hot topic, always controversial, all the way back to when Bill and Bob, the controversy about them receiving royalties for big book sales, and they felt perplexed about that. They went to their friend Father Ed Dowling, who eventually came back to them saying, look, You shouldn't be paid for 12-step work, but you should be paid for special services. And there it was born. Really, the principle behind a tradition started right there. I wanted to read this. Bill Wilson did this talk to the Manhattan Group in 1955. The talk was called "The Road from the Table on Clinton Hill, on Clinton Street." Excuse me. What I was trying to do is I was trying to find one of the first examples that someone of these full-time workers was employed, as it's mentioned in the eighth tradition. And I don't know if I found the first one, but this fireman, ex-fireman on pension, his name was Tom, and this is what Bill said in his talk. "When the club was opened, we moved into one of those rooms there. Tom M. came over from the V's, and right then and there, a tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous was generated. It seemed that volunteers had been sweeping the club. It seemed that the alcoholics had keys to the club, and they came and went and sometimes stayed. And sometimes they got very drunk and acted very badly, doing we know not what. There had to be somebody there to really look after the place. So we thought we'd approach old Tom, who had a pension as a fireman. We said, 'Tom, how would you like to come and live at the club? Thank you.' Tom says, 'What's on your mind?' 'Well,' we said, 'we really need somebody here all the time, you know, to make the coffee and see that the place is heated and throw some coal in that furnace over there and lead the drunks outside if they're too bad.' 'Ain't you going to pay me?' Tom says. 'Oh, no,' we said. 'This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We can't have any professionals.' Tom says, 'I do my 12-step work. I don't charge them nothing. But you guys want is a janitor. And if you're going to get me, you're going to have to pay, see?' Well, we were very much disturbed about our situation. And we weren't exactly paid. They were just passing the hat for us, you understand. I think that we went for 7 years of the history of the society with an average income of $1,700 a year, which, for a former stockbroker, is not too big. So this question of who is a professional and who isn't bore very heavily at the time on Tom and me, and Tom began to get it settled. He began to show that if a special service was asked for from anybody full-time, we'd have to pay or not get it. So Bill had this, along with a lot of other people, what he called this this pile of fuzzy thinking about money in AA. And he felt like that pile of fuzzy thinking came from a common source, which is fear. But it wasn't fear of the use of money in AA. It was fear of the misuse of money in AA. One thing I was sort of caught by when I was reading this pamphlet on the traditions is there's this catch 22 for Bill, which was that, like, say for example, AA needed a secretary full time. He felt they needed that secretary to be alcoholic because she or she would need to have that alcoholic pitch. But as soon as an AA member would take the post, they'd get shunned from their group. And I was a little shocked by that. But that's what was going on. They were perceived as someone who was taking money to do AA work. They were shunned. They weren't asked to speak. And I imagine it got really intense. And I'm sure that there were people who thought money shouldn't be involved at all. But money already was, because at this point, AA wasn't in living rooms anymore. It was clubhouses, and it had grown, and there was literature. It wasn't about the use of money in AA. It was about keeping an eye on the misuse of money in AA. It wasn't that money was evil. It's that people aren't perfect. I think I have enough time to talk about this story, and I wanted to. After I left San Antonio from the convention, I went to Dallas to see my family and spend some time there, spent about a month to do some work and reconnect with old friends. And I met this guy at my mom's home group called Primary Purpose, a guy named Ed. I had been looking for a chance to maybe do some service while I was in town. So I approached him. I didn't know that he had a very tough going, that he had had two wives, both of whom he had lost, one to suicide, and that his current wife had just undergone her third brain surgery. And I didn't know that his son, Scott, had just passed away 3 months ago from addiction. I approached him because I thought that he looked like he had a great message and was very active, and he was someone I could talk to about service while I was in Dallas. So I asked him, and he said, "Oh, sure, sure, Scott. I don't know about your program. I don't know what you guys do up in New York. Do you know what a commitment is?" And I said, "Oh, sure, oh, sure." And I regaled him about coffee and shaking hands and literature and the stuff that I do at my home group. He's like, "Oh, Scott, that's great. That's great service to do for your home group. But why don't you come with me on Thursday, and I'll show you what a commitment is." So I hopped in his truck on Thursday, and we went to the Salvation Army, where he brought this message of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous once a week, every week for 15 years to this group of men who no longer had choices and no longer had options and were living at the Salvation Army. And I bring that up not just because I'm enamored of him, but when I think about 15 years of a commitment, I think if it were up to me and I were running the show, and it's a good thing that I'm not, that I would think not only should that man be paid, but it's probably about time for him to have a raise. And the thing is that's what I mean about money not being evil, but people not being perfect. It's not like that would be with bad intention. I think it would be with good intention. It would be with devastating result. That it would snowball. If we paid him, how much should we pay him? How much should we pay the next person? And now 12-step work isn't spiritual, it's financial. Thank you. I had wanted to read one more thing from the 12 and 12, but I have 1 minute. And I think I just want to reiterate to make sure that it's clear, and then please read about this tradition, the 12 and 12. It's really beautiful. That this 12-step work, as I said a bunch of times earlier, is always to be done for free. In fact, the majority of everything that we do in AA is voluntary. And then there's this small percentage that isn't, and that's full-time. That's someone who's working full-time as a secretary who is going to receive a salary that's comparable to what a secretary would receive. And that's it. That's that small percentage. Thank you very much for letting me share.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Tara S.
Was that good?
Is that it?
Hi, I'm Tara Stephacker. I'm an alcoholic. Kind of had a funny feeling that I might be getting up here pretty soon. And it's really an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak here. There's the microphone. Yeah, I'm used to being able to walk and talk and use my hands. I'm part Italian, and I don't mind being at the front of the room. So standing in one place is a little tough for me. I have one speed that I really like. It's called facelift. Some things change slowly. My sobriety date is December 13, 2000. My sponsor is Cindy M.M. She lives out of town. What's changed since I've come in is that I've gotten the willingness to travel out of town to go and see someone to whom I will listen. What's changed since I've come in is that I have the willingness to put on a dress when I'm told and get up and share my experience. Because my experience was that I wore a dress until I went to college. And several years after that, I had the blessing to get sober, which I had no intention of doing, and I'll tell you briefly why. But nobody was ever going to tell me when to put on a dress again. Which was pretty funny because I owned at least 25 dresses. Because my 12 steps were up and down the streets of Manhattan. And I shopped an awful lot. And I kept a lot of secrets. And I still connived. And I was, you know, I had some time away from the booze. And my time with the booze started when I was young. And I got away with a lot, and I also didn't get away with a lot. I was an alcoholic from the get-go. I had one person to whom I would listen when I was a kid. That was my dad. My dad was a force recon Marine in Vietnam. I had a little trouble with authority. Yeah. So I came in, I did what I wanted, I went through the steps, I kept some things to myself, I wouldn't wear a dress, I wouldn't come to AG. I started coming here several years ago, and I was invited to come on Tuesday nights. I was going to the Big Book meeting. And I had something else to do on Tuesday nights, because I was really cool. It's also the reason that I'm going to be 10 years sober in December. This summer was my first convention, because I thought those things were for nerds. Yeah, Guess who went to the convention this summer and had a better time than any parking lot at any dead show ever? Yeah. So, I started drinking young. I drank a lot. I drank hard. I drank with people who were older than me. I stole my parents' booze. I stole cars. I did a lot of that stuff. I got away with a lot. I conned a lot. I got away a lot with just by the skin of my teeth. So, women started trying to 12-step me when I was 19, and I wasn't going to come in because I didn't need to get sober. And I finally heard the message 9 years later, and I got sober. And the message kind of was, your life's really not working for you, so why don't you try it this way? And for the first time ever, I said, okay. So I started doing it, and slowly I started doing it and started doing it, and then I really started doing it. And my life has gotten so much better. You know, it's amazing, the simplicity of taking direction. So that's something new for me. And I'm very grateful for that. Like I said, I work with a sponsor. She's out of town. I work with her because I listen to her. I have a sponsee here in New York. There have been times that I've had many sponsees. I've worked out of town. I've gone to meetings out of town. It's been a fast several years. We had a wonderful talk on the eighth tradition, and I heard the phrase, for fun and for free, which is something my sponsor often says to me. It's something her sponsor says to her. It's something his sponsor said to him. When I'm really bucking and chafing, she goes up the ladder to him and she brings in the big guns. I stop bucking and chafing. but for fun and for free, it's why it's such a privilege for me to get up here tonight and to talk about this, because there are still things that maybe I don't want to do. When I'm confronted with right and wrong, and the wrong thing looks easy and the right thing looks scary, I jump off the cliff and I do the right thing. Because not only does she say to me, this is for fun and for free, she doesn't yell at me. She doesn't chastise me. She says, how free do you want to be? And I've come to realize that alcoholism is like the ocean. And I now have a higher power who created the ocean, something that those people in all those schools that made me wear those dresses for all those years tried to tell me, and I couldn't hear it. I never did very well in science anyway, so, you know, whoever created the ocean, you want to believe whatever, my higher power created the ocean. took a long time, but I finally got it. I worked pretty hard at that. You know, there were times that it was easier in early sobriety. I was really strong physically, and pretty much all I did was work out to try to keep my sanity. I would work out and go to meetings, and I would run several miles a day to quiet the brain and pray and pray and pray. And then a couple years ago, I got sick, and I couldn't run, and I couldn't work out, and I couldn't do yoga. So I couldn't be physically exhausted anymore trying to meditate. So I had to get a little more surrendered, and my higher power had to get a little bit bigger. And then, you know, some different things happened. You know, loss of parents, one parent. And what did I do differently? Well, I didn't fight with anybody. I called for help in the middle of the night. I took direction. I was told, you have to go help your stepmother now. And I went to any lengths to do that, to show up for someone else. You know, it was no longer me, 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 and what can I get? I'm here, I'm sober, I deserve. It was, what can I do for someone else? And what can I do for this person who brought me into the world? And that was for free. That was someone who saw me get sober. And I'm very lucky to be here. I shouldn't be here. One of the reasons I know that my higher power is who he is and I'm going to tell you this because there's probably someone here who needs to hear it, because nothing happens by mistake. I tried to kill myself several times, starting when I was very young. I didn't take a couple extra Tylenol. I went for a gun. They've told me for a long time that I have a very well above average IQ. It's not that hard to get the safety off a gun. Didn't work. I was drinking very heavily one night, no surprise, and, you know, I just happen to have some explosives. You know, doesn't everybody just keep, you know, like M80s on their dresser, you know, like in the cup with your parking change? All right, maybe not. But I did. So I tried to tape an M80 to my forehead. And there was someone there who got the matches away from me. And I say that because there might be someone here who's really feeling like this isn't going to work and she hates herself and she could just walk out that door and end it. And I didn't get to end it. So I got to be here, and I got to share this message. And, you know, when those feelings came up several years into sobriety, those feelings came up because I was in some problems, and those problems were of my own making. And they were of my own making because of my own self-will and by the lies of omission. That means not telling someone. And that means telling someone everything. Which I have finally done. So what did I take for those feelings? I took some direction. You know, I've had more stuff offered to me since I've gotten sober almost than I had offered to me before I got sober, and that's really saying something. You know, because when you're a bartender in a lot of places, people offer you a lot of stuff. And it's just, it's not for me. That's the kind of brain and body chemistry that I have. You know, I have, there's a still somewhere inside here, and it can turn anything into booze, so I don't pick it up. So in closing, I do what I'm told. That means a dress and closed-toe shoes. That's what it means. It means sharing honestly to help someone else. It means helping someone one-on-one, and it means going on those 12-step calls for free. You know, if it's, you know, you go to someone's house to pour something out, or you tell someone your experience, you know, and that's my job. You know, it's not, I thought it was the corner office, I thought it was this, I thought it was that, I thought it was a bunch of externals that I had, and I was wrong. And, you know, I've had the pleasure and the blessing of knowing people who've seen me get sober, and the thing that they loved the most and admired the most was that I had gotten sober because they knew from where I came. So if that's where I came from and someone else is suffering, they can get sober too. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, woo! Woo! Yeah, thank you. Woo AA. Woo indeed. Hi, my name is Jero and I'm an alcoholic. And this is super cool to be here. Thank you, Jeff, for asking me to speak. It's an honor and a privilege to speak at any meeting, but particularly my home group. Wow. I came here so jacked up. I've had a really, really stressful week and last week and starting to be another one. And then I came here and was racing around trying to get checks from people for literature, and I was just all wound up. And I'm like, how am I going to speak? How am I going to get focused enough to carry some sort of sensible message? And then I was able to sit and I was able to listen to Scott give a great 8th tradition talk and to hear Tara and then just watch the meeting unfold. You know, Scott with one day and Brooke out there belting out 48 days and Phil zooming in and crashing into the podium and Greg from New Jersey. Yes, that counts. Welcome. You know, I love you guys and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And like Liz always says, if you hear nothing else from me tonight, know that I love AA. And my whole life I wanted to be an alcoholic. And I know that's not how most qualifications start, but this is absolutely true. Like, I grew up in an alcoholic household, and my parents had a lot of parties. And, you know, the worst people were the most fun. Like, the guys that would just say the shocking thing, or just they'd knock over something or break a chair. But they got away with it, and like I was not good at getting away with things. But like it just, they seemed to be having more fun, and people let them slide because they were a little bit cooler, maybe. And so, you know, at a young age, I that was something that I was very attracted to. You know, I was a bartender at age 7, and I knew it was going to be important to like at these parties, not like professionally. And I knew it was important to learn the difference between, like, scotch and scotch whiskey and what's bourbon. I don't know what to do, but, like, I was just pouring things in a glass, and here you go, no ice, which made me popular with the alcoholics. But I always wanted to be like that when I started drinking. And when I started drinking, I was psyched because I was an awkward kid. And, you know, that drink did something for me. And it was electric. My first real drunk was a blackout, and you know, it was at this, you know, Christmas party, and you know, the girl was there, and like, you know, when I say the girl, like, it's like, you know, the sides of my vision would get all hazy, like an 80s sitcom flashback, and I was just like, and she's like, hey, do you want a drink? And we're at this Christmas party, and there are these older Australian kids who are like, yeah, come on, man, you're a legend. I bet you can't drink half a bottle of wine. So I'm like, and I'm a legend, and you know. And, you know, I jumped the ladder. I forget about the girl. Like, I tried to kiss her older, hotter sister. And I don't remember. Then there's, like, scene missing. And then I threw up in every room in the house. And, you know, that was sort of... But that was my start. Because I didn't look at that part. It was just the beginning of the night. And, you know, I wanted to get good at drinking. You know, I had some other friends who were also wanted to be good at drinking. And, you know, when you're 15 and you drink hard and you have a house that you're allowed to have parties at, all of a sudden, regardless of, you know, your inclinations, you become one of the cool kids. And so I was really excited to be one of the cool kids because I did not feel cool on the inside. But when I drank, I felt pretty cool. And, you know, I knew from early on that, you know, this was going to be a problem. And, you know, when I was 16, disaster struck and my mom got sober. And she needed it, but, like, it made it harder to have, like, 80 kids over on a Friday night. And so, you know, we still have the parties, but we'd have to kind of tone it down a little bit. And, you know, I was talking with a friend of mine. We were, like, about 16, and his mom was sober, too. And we said, you know, eventually we're going to have to do this AA thing, you know? And he's like, yeah, I know. And today we're both doing that AA thing. So, like, that's kind of cool. You know, this is a progressive disease, but I was exhibiting, you know, symptoms of late stage alcoholism at 18. I drank myself sober at the prom. I started drinking at noon, like a bottle of vodka, and then I killed the bottle of vodka and moved on to the rum. And by the time like the dance was over and we were going to the after parties, I could not get drunk. And you've never seen a sadder camper than like a guy who's sober at the prom and does not want to be. And, you know, I just like, what's the point? Why am I, you know, why am I even talking to people? I was miserable. And, you know, I'm surrounded by people, but I'm miserable because I can't be drinking. I'm going to steal Tara's water. Thank you, Tara. You know, I liked being a reckless drunk. You know, at some point early on in my, like around 13, when I really started picking up alcohol, things weren't going well at home. And I was not getting life on my terms. And I sort of had it with God. Up until this point, I had been pretty religious, or at least attending church regularly. And, you know, I just said, you know, I've had it. And I made a decision that I was going to pursue this drinking thing. And I was going to run it down to the end of the road. And I thought one of two things would happen. Either I'd have this really exceptional Hunter Thompson-like life, or I would die before I was 30. And, you know, when your 10-year plan, 15-year plan is to die before you're 30, you don't make a lot of really good choices up until that point because, you know, why try to get into a good college, you know, so you can get a job? I mean, I'm not long for this world. And, you know, so I made these choices, and what happens is that I make these choices, and then those choices start making other choices for me. And then before you know it, all my choices get made. And I didn't know that I was sacrificing so much for my drinking. I thought I was calling the shots. You know, I liked sports and I was decent. You know, my freshman year I was in 3 varsity sports. My sophomore year, 2 varsity sports. My junior year, 1 varsity sport. You see where this is going. Senior year it was duck duck goose on the quad. And I remember when I quit wrestling, the coach looked at me and he said, you know, Giroux, you always take the path of least resistance. You know, I feel like you're someone who's looking for something, but you're not going to find it out there in the woods with your friends. And, you know, I'd like to find this guy today and thank him because that stuck. I did not like it at the time. And, you know, I didn't want to hear it, but, like, it stayed with me. So when I was 18, there was, you know, I was having problems with my drinking. And so I went to a couple AA meetings. I was not ready. You know, everyone there was considerably older and considerably just, I had everything wrong. And, you know, I did not want your phone number. I did not want your rhyming advice, you know, and I certainly did not want to stop drinking. That was the big problem. Man, I liked your stories, and maybe we would have hung out in a different world, but, like, because I liked the way you drank, but I did not like the not drinking part of your program. So, you know, I started, when they went around the room, some people said, I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm like, oh, that's for me. And so I said, I'm a Giroux, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict, because that makes me a little bit different, doesn't it? You know, this is just me. If you dual identify, awesome. Like, this is my own path and my own twisted thoughts. But, like, for me, it was a way for me to ease myself up off of your not drinking plan. So the next time I came, and I was Roe, and I'm an addict. And no one said, hey, get out of here, man. You know, this is for alcoholics. So I could kind of come and be different and not really have to stop drinking. That was my thinking. So clearly, that didn't work. I needed some more consequences in my life, and so I went out and proceeded to get some more consequences. I went to college. That was a bit of a mess. I became one of those guys, you know, that guy. And, you know, I was reckless. I was determined to drink myself to death. And, you know, I was doing things for the sake of the story. And, you know, these things stop being cute after a while. You know, like the constant betrayals, you know, of trust and friendship, the stealing when you've got plenty of money, but, you know, they have stuff that you want. You know, just the shady, just inexplicable behavior. I would start fights because I have a perceived slight. You know, like I didn't even know you, but you're across the room and I decided I hate you. And if you come over here, I'm going to have to hit you. Like, insanity. I don't know that guy, but I'm halfway into this fight with him. I'm dragging other people into it too. And like, you know, it just got very, very uncomfortable. The last year of my drinking, I had gotten, you know, some pretty bad, like, alcoholic insomnia, I feel like, because I could not pass out. I could not fall asleep. So, like, whenever I was up, I would just sit and I'd pick apart my life and, you know, all the things that were wrong with it. And I could see every single aspect of my life that was, you know, falling apart. And I could see all of it except how alcohol played a part in that. I was so blind to it. You know, and I continued to sacrifice more and more things, you know. I intend to just go to the bar and see who was there. I mean, after all, I've got a test tomorrow. I can't really be out tonight. And, you know, so then I see people, no one's there that I want to talk to besides the bartender, but I'm there. And so I'm like, well, I'll stay till midnight. And then midnight rolls around. And I say, well, closing time, and then I'll just pull an all-nighter and it'll be great. And then like 2 o'clock, I say, well, I can just drop that class. Not very important. So, you know, at this point, I'm drinking to pass out. The summer of 99 was a really ugly one. I was working on this movie about a biker bar, and so I did a lot of research. And, you know, it was a mess. Like, there was, like, a little window when I'd get off of work at 5, and before, like, you could reasonably go to a bar at, like, 8, where I would just pace, you know, my dad's apartment like a caged animal, just jumping out of my skin, because I could not not drink any longer. I was insane. I was hungry. Not thirsty for a drink. I was hungry for it. And, you know, this went on for, you know, 9 months. I was just miserable. Every morning, or afternoon, I'd wake up, and, like, I was disappointed that the amount of stuff I'd put into my body the night before was not enough to kill me. You know, I wanted to die, but lacked the courage of my conviction to, you know, take any action on that part. You know, the best, like, reason I could think of for not doing it was my parents just leased me a new car, and how messed up would that be if they had to continue to make monthly payments on their dead son's car? So, happy camper, and Y2K rolls around, and, okay, so, all right, yeah, Y2K rolls around. Some of you have heard this before. You remember how they told you your bank account's going to get wiped out. The missiles are going to fire. Elevators are going to crash. Empires to the ground. We're starting from scratch because of two little numbers. I was so excited. I was so excited. This was my get out of jail free. Like, I had painted myself into such a corner. I'm coming to the end of my first senior year of college where, you know, I'm not qualified to work. I'm not even qualified to, like, work for free, like, as an intern. If I showed up, I was doing you a favor. I had everything and appreciated nothing and a huge sense of entitlement. So, you know, not very employable. I've got habits that I would need to be making 6 figures out of college, unlikely, and so apocalypse seemed like a good plan. If we all had to just reset and go and live in the forest and collect berries, I have a compound bow. You know, I can hunt. I could perhaps lead a tribe. So that didn't work. That didn't pan out, as you might have noticed. And so we're all here, and I needed a new plan. And my new plan was I hooked up with this professional class of drinkers, and we went on like a 5-day run. Like we drank, like we would drink until the bars closed, and then we'd go to the clubs. And when the clubs closed, we'd check into a hotel, and you know, we would we'd do this for 5 days. And halfway through this, I came home for an intervention. Thank you very much. My mom said, we're going to an intervention. And, you know, it wasn't mine, which was wild. So it was the older brother of this guy, this girl that I had been, you know, on this run with. And, you know, we went there, and I said, listen, man, you're a mess, and I think you should go to rehab. And the conversation started to take an uncomfortable turn because there were a lot of people there talking about, you know, maybe you might want to keep him company. So I left, and I went with his sister for a couple more days, and then I hit the wall. And I was down on the ground, and I was done. And I was curled up in a ball on the floor, you know, crying. And my mom said, are you okay? And I told her everything. Okay, I'm good. I just got the 15 minutes, and I told Tess if I was still drinking at 15, I'm going to put 20 in the basket next week. So I'm done. So this is what happened. My mom said, "Okay, let's take a walk." And she got on the phone, and I was afraid she was calling the AA police. And so, like, I'm like, "Get off the phone now!" But like, let's take a walk. And so we took a walk, and this SUV pulls up. And I'm getting shoved into this shotgun seat of this car, and like I go for the door, and the child locks come down, and I thought that finally the CIA had caught up with me, and I look and at the wheel of the car is the guy whose intervention I had been at 2 days before, and off we went to my first meeting as an active participant, and when they asked if anyone was new, my hand went up. Not of its own accord, not by my own doing. And, you know, I found myself saying, my name is Jerome, an alcoholic, and I've got 5 hours sober. And that blew my mind. Because I didn't realize that until it came out of my mouth. And so, you know, I followed this guy like a puppy for my first, you know, week or two. And, you know, it was the blind leading the blind, but we were going to meetings. And, you know, his 2 days more than me, you know, was helping me. When I was falling apart at day 9, he said, "Oh, yeah, day 9's the worst." but day 10 gets a lot better. And so I'm like, "All right, okay, I can hang in there then." And so that was enough. That was enough to keep me coming. Against the advice of everybody, I went back to school to live in my fraternity. Yeah, it was not a great idea. However, I'm here to tell you that if you're willing to take certain actions, you can get sober in any condition. You know, I made it much more difficult for myself. You know, I would not recommend it. However, you know, if those are your circumstances, those are your circumstances. And I did. I lived with 40 heavy drinkers, and only one of them said, "I think you should drink again." The rest of them were very supportive of what I was trying to do. And so I went to meetings there for my first year in at school, and I was crazy. I did everything wrong except get a commitment and show up at meetings. I shared at ninth step meetings one of the 37 days thinking you wanted my insight, the profound wisdom of my years that I could offer you on something I've never done. And when people said, you know, when I was new, they told me to take the cotton out of my ears and stick it in my mouth. I was so dense, I didn't even know they were saying that to me. I said, "Wow, that's crazy that they said that. How did you feel?" You know, like, so clueless. But despite that, I stayed sober. And it wasn't until my year that I realized there was no way I could have done this. You know, that like, I was the guy who took the path of least resistance every time. You know, my higher power was involved. And, you know, I began to build this relationship with my higher power. When I had about 4 months, I had a white light experience. And it was totally crazy. Like I heard the voice of God and I felt the warmth and I was just, you know, freaked out. But I knew that there was a higher power out there that cared for me and loved me and that I was going to be taken care of. The problem with this spiritual experience is that it was not a spiritual awakening. You know, the next day I was the same jerk I had been the night before. And I didn't get a spiritual awakening until I went through these steps. So I moved back to New York. I bummed around here for a while. And, you know, I was going to meetings. I had a sponsor that was not very interested in step work, and which is great because I was too dumb to be taught. And, you know, I stayed sick in AA. And, you know, eventually I found the man that would become my sponsor. And he went to every meeting on the Upper East Side ever. No matter what meeting I went to, no matter what time of day or at night, the guy was there and he was doing service. And one night I was at the Stargate Diner. It's like doing fellowship, and I told some guy that the second step wasn't actually really a step. It's a step. If you're new, it's absolutely a step. But like, I thought that it was, you know, I had done some outside reading about the Oxford Group, okay, guys? And they had six steps. And so I was telling this, you know, this guy from Brooklyn, you know, with the motorcycle jacket and the slick back hair, I'm like, hey, no, listen, you know, Bill, he basically just spread it out a bit, you know, to spoon feed you. You know, two is like, do you have a higher power? Okay, good, let's do three. And this guy told me to shut up. He said, shut your mouth because you don't know what you're talking about and you could get somebody killed. And then he started to explain to me that, you know, the second step is that I have this problem that is going to kill me. And that my thinking is so twisted that I want to get killed. And that I can't fix that. That you know, the second step is more bad news. I'm going to die. You know, and my only shot is to, like, get something to fix my brain. And that thing has to be something greater than me, obviously. And he said, and from what it sounds like, you stand to be, you know, restored to sanity. And so when this guy came up for air 20 minutes later into going into me, you know, I asked him if he'd hear my fifth step. And he said, okay, how about next week? And I said, well, I haven't exactly written the fourth step. And so he said, okay, how about 2 weeks? And, you know, this started my journey with Mark like 9 years ago. And you know, we went to the beginning of the book, and we went page by page, and we did the big book in the 12 and 12. And as a result of that, I began to change and grow, and old attitudes began to, you know, go by the wayside slowly. And then I'd done the steps, and I'd entered into a fearsome and exciting adolescent period. If you're laughing, that's because you read the second forward. I had this experience of Alcoholics Anonymous outlined in this book, and some of you guys was not doing it this way. And you needed to know that I knew how it should be done. And I would wave this. It was like, does anybody read this thing? I was so sick. And, you know, like, it was really unhealthy. You know, this spiritual arrogance of like, I need to tear you down. I need to take your inventory to show you that I'm doing it right. And, you know, it took a while to back away from that. You know, it took a while and some perspective to see that, you know, I do not have all the answers. You know, I have had an experience that has worked for me and for many. But I've been around long enough to know that people stay sober doing it other ways too. You know, like, this is not the only game in town. This is a very good game. This is the one that I would recommend. You know, if you're trying it another way and you're unhappy and you think that, you know, AA is a drag and life is about complaining about all the injustices that get thrown your way, then I suggest, you know, maybe trying it the way outlined in here. However, you know, it's like, do it your own way. That's cool too. My sponsor taught me you can do whatever you want to do if you're willing to accept the consequences of your actions. And my problem is, I didn't know what the consequences of my actions were half the time. And so I needed to have someone explain that to me. That, you know, like, that there are repercussions. And somewhere along the line, I began to actually really want this thing. You know, I wasn't just killing time in AA. Like, I made a decision somewhere to give my life to this program. You know, everything in my life, as my old wrestling coach had told me, had just been like, you know, half measures. You know, it had just been just the feeble attempt to show up and get a passing grade. And like, I wanted to do one thing excellent for the first time. And I'm not saying that I do AA excellently, but I want to. I want this, you know, like, this has been the center of my life, you know. And that doesn't mean to the exclusion of anything else. You know, making this the center of my life has increased the depth of my experience in life. You know, the fact that, you know, I'm no longer choosing the friends and lovers that I know I'm going to end up, we're going to hurt each other. You know, that I'm not trying to take things from people. That I'm learning how to become a son. I'm learning, you know, I'm learning how to become a brother and a friend. And, you know, it's an incredible journey, you know, like, and like, as I start learning these lessons, like, God keeps throwing these, like, pop quizzes at me, and it's like, the lessons are, like, written all across the face of my life. You know, it's amazing. Like, I can see it. I can see it when I get some difficult thing happening, there's something I need to be learning there. You know, sometimes the way God writes is so big that I can't see the message, and so I need to step back and get a little distance before I can see what's going on. And that's okay too, because, you know, I've been through enough, like, on this journey that, like, I can see that whatever does happen, it's going to work out. It's already actually working out right now. And the reason why I know that is because everything that's happened up until this point has worked out. You know, I mean, there have been setbacks. There have been, you know, hard times and sadness and regrets, sure. But I've learned from them. You know, I don't repeat those mistakes today. And so they cease to become, you know, hardships, and they start to become teachers, you know, lessons, and opportunities for growth. And sometimes they sting a bit, but, you know, it's always growth. It's always, you know, a little bit of improvement. And so I don't have to worry. I don't have to worry as much. So this is how I, you know, come to terms with the third step, really. You know, that, like, I can give my life and my will over to my higher power, knowing that I'm going to be taken care of because everything else has been fine, you know? Today, everything in my life is actually very kind of complicated. It's difficult. There are a lot of things that I wish my higher power didn't have such faith in me. But you know what? Like, the really cool thing is that someday I'm going to be able to take those things and, you know, whatever the nasty lump is, I'm going to have a sponsee going through something just like that. And I can be like, hey, man, I did that. I was right there with you a couple years ago. And, you know, this is what I did. And because I have a sponsor that, you know, I admire so much, I love and respect, and who runs so much harder than me, you know, like, it keeps me on my game to want to be like that. And so I know that I have that same obligation to, you know, the men I get to work with. You know, that I don't want to take that half measure step when I, you know, I'd love an easier, softer way. You know, no, like, I do the right thing so that I can tell them that it works. Not tell them, I want to show them that this works. And, you know, I've never regretted doing the right thing, which is, you know, wild. I've also learned that I really don't know what's going to happen. You know, I had resigned myself to watching my father drink and smoke himself to death. And, you know, now he's got about 4 months sober, and he's sitting in the front row, and that's crazy.